Did you McCutcheon reel three?
It lost the blame I had all night, some of it in a stiff neck. That's not an injury. But it was very close to it.
Any other narrow escapes you had?
We're just coming up on a bunch of the jungle on patrol. Same sort of thing. That's the way we went. Performing, so like an ordinary formation, you're sort of forming up to attack. Point X, Y, Z or whatever. But we were mainly at that stage, because we were mainly patrolling for the jungle, so we were always in small numbers.
How did you feel about the performance of your Gurkhas?
They performed very well. All things considered, they were very good. I don't want to do the fight, but I think they were. They bore with fortitude the discomforts. And they were, I suppose, like I say, they were better equipped to deal with discomforts than European or British people who live in cities and towns and so on. They did their own life in the hills and the falls, fairly rigorous life. It was not no great comfort with monsoon and knocking their houses down and so on. They were very tougher than our people, obviously. But they still had to live through all this. They did very well.
Could you discover what their attitude towards the Japanese enemy was?
They were the enemy, it was all simple. And I think to this extent, Gurkha is very simple minded. And in that, not only really simple minded in the sense of the pejorative use of the word, they were. If the Sirkar said, government said they were the enemy, they were the enemy as far as they were concerned. I think also they had heard or something like that.
What about the villagers in the area that you were in? Did you run into them very much?
Oh, quite a lot, yes. Quite a lot. They were actually in the midst. In the south part of Antwerp, Barmerish way, they were mixed Shams and Burmans who had a very bad reputation after, I think possibly unjustified, after the run back in 1941 of collaborating with the Japanese. But once you got up into the, what do I call, the tribal areas, the Chins and Kachins, the Chins on the east, the west of the one, the Kachins on the west, 100% cooperation. Anyway, they come in with information. I remember being on a small outpost, helping on an airdrop. And a funny old lady came out of the village and dived from my pack. My bat and all, the same one as hell, a day later. And I just came out. She shook it off. Produced, we all had pint pots. Narrow pint pot, green. And she sees this and she pours some liquid into it. She said, you know that, you'll feel much better or worse. I can understand vaguely what she was saying. It was the rice wine, Uzu, like the, and they call it Zue, you know, not Uzu, and sake. And she gave us the other stuff that I said that was lovely, and I don't know if it's actually marvelous. But otherwise, they were very helpful. There were a large number of ex Burma military police in that area who've been recruited who now are on pension. And indeed, in certain villages, one of Gurkhas. You saw on the map a place marked a Gurkha you are, YWA, in the Gurkha village. And these were Gurkhas had come to serve in the Burmese army, going back to the early days of the conquest of Burma, and settled. but they still maintain their strong staunch characteristics and are very helpful. Very helpful. No criticism at all. And they did fall, as I say, there were these Mackie forces in the north, Fort Hurst levies, the North Kachin levies, and others, which were Dar force, and others, which were Kachin, to be differentiated from Burmans, serving under Burma Rifle officers, or mainly British officers. The Koreans, whom we didn't meet as such, but they're rather further south, are still at it. And they were magnificent. They were the Koreans, they were the pick of the bunch. They're very inefficient. When they got commissioned, they lived off the British officers' messes exactly one to one. I mean, there was no. There was no sort of subservient, or what the Negroes might call Uncle Tom attitude. And they were there, and they were there right. And they behaved beautifully.
Were you able to give anything to the villagers?
Sometimes you get some if it's spare rations. Well, this was a problem. He couldn't have much maybe spare rations. He could only carry so much. Everything we had to be carried by us.
Money?
Well, we had money. We had each officer had a bunch of notes to give them. I don't know how value that was, because of course at that time the Bamboo currency was being occupied by they themselves, although they were probably being sensible, didn't know when the war was going to end. What good was a handful of Indian currency or Burmese or Burmese currency to them when there was, the Jets you ask questions, where did you get that from? I mean, they probably do them all of no good, suspecting that they were collaborating. We didn't have enough money. But mainly, I think, we thought the thing we gave them was friendship and parachute silk.
Did you come across any retaliation against the villagers by the Japanese?
Well, this ambush put down by Ali Hayward was our retaliation for an engagement of the village. We were moving on rather fast after that. We couldn't take it back and sort of do anything. We sorted them out as we met them. And of course, by the time we got to Michener, there was hardly any villages occupied by the locals left. They were all empty. In the case of the two places we were on the outskirts of Michener, Wangmore and Mine now, they were Japanese virtually.
Was there any problem at all with discipline of your men in the jungle?
No. There was one very minor one, fairly early on, when strict orders were that on an airdrop, nobody was to help themselves. Even to broken nose, all to be handed in to the column quartermaster, who then divided out. And one of the chefs helping the airdrop came up on a broken container and was seen putting stuff in his pocket. And he was tied to a tree for an hour just to show our displeasure. He didn't resent it, and the man supported it. But above that, we never anything at all.
What had he taken? Food?
Part of, if I recall, it was part of a K ration packet. It was food. American K ration. Which is infinitely better than ours, they say. No complaint. Well, we complained about it. But they were very, very much better than any emergency ration that we met provided with the British Army. Or the Indian Army.
Did the men ever get to a starved condition? Did your men ever get into a starved condition?
No. We never got to that condition. We missed one airdrop, I think. And we had still 4 or 5 days, but no, usually we found that there were bits and pieces food you left over, you could do. And also you could go to the inn yourself. Well, I don't know why I came and went to the inn. It was the most magnificent rice I've ever had. Produced by him, it's cooked and wrapped up in prawns. No, not being a sort of season away, you're always able to get eventually a ration stop through. And being a small family, a small party, wasn't a great effort in aircraft airlift to crop sorties to supply surplus. But you know, I've heard it before, there was a 5-day cycle. The airdrops came in, carried the food for 5 days, you were resting for 5 days. But we never got in a situation in our particular lot where the Japanese intervention made supply drops impossible. So we were, I can't say we were fit living in Britain, but we never really got down to hunger, real hunger. We didn't start eating a mule or each other.
So the airdrop system worked smoothly, did it? Or were there any problems?
Yes, I think it did work smoothly. There were unavoidable problems. Sort of unavoidable. This was caused by weather conditions. They couldn't see, they couldn't come in. When the thing came down, monsoon came down, it was new. And we couldn't contact them. But apart from that, once rather amusing incident, stupid one. We working too well. We used to send in an indent to the airbase, what we wanted, standard demand. If it gave the strength of the column, that meant so many days rations were gotten. So then we had other bits and bobs to go in, anything special. And the Burger officer, commanding the machine gun section, wanted a spare, very minor spring with machine gun. And he explained to the Colonel Corporal Marston that he had just enough to go on, he hadn't a reserve, and he wanted a reserve. Okay, so he was tagged off to the indent, and it went. And the indent, of course, was a code, security code, but instead of writing out pin what it is for a machine gun, medium machine gun, mark so and so. It was a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever the number was. And it was one digit removed from a whole machine gun. So the next year, the whole machine gun came down. But we never carried a stampede because we were serving, we were serving harnesses and saddles to carry a machine gun. So what we did was we took the spring off that one. We had to carry this machine gun. So some of the giant Burmese jungle is a complete machine gun, unless this particular spring buried. So that was unavoidable. Other time, it would very well with Mark and the Lord. And he was very person of our armies over the tour. Apart from the fact that all frontline troops disliking people in the air, and it's a second in the hand of the war. Yeah, it would work extremely well. I can't recall any ghastly mistakes, no, there are none.
What did you think of the performance of the mules?
Well, I'm a mule man. They're 100% mule. Much better than horses, though. They're terrific animals. Although I knew they were being loyal, working hard, I don't know. I had the misfortune to have to shoot one, which was very badly wounded by a Japanese mortar. And its throat was cut by a splinter, and it was still careering around, and we got it and had to shoot in the head. And that was very sad occurrence to me, but the rest of them were our friends. I mean, they really were. And we, it was a great sorrow when we had to hand them over when we came out. And then over to the 9th Royal Sussex Regiment, who were going on down the road.
Did you ever eat any mules?
No. We never got this thing. No.
Did you have vets with them?
We had transport officers who had some sort of veterinary training. In my way, sort of paramedic, whatever you had to call them. It so happens that in 30 Column, one of the officers was not only the son of the major failure of the weeks, but was a qualified vet.
The son of who?
McGillicuddy's Reeks, in the Irish.
McGillicuddy's Reeks?
Yes.
The mountains?
Yes, in the South Kalai, the McGillicuddy clan came from. His father was the McGillicuddy, as we call it. He was killed in Burma, unfortunately. But he was also a fully qualified vet. Because he was, I think, in the village eaten, I'm not sure. And then he became a vet. Fully, he looked like an Ireland. Came to the war, he joined his father's old regiment, the 4th 7th Dragoon Guards. Fought with them in France to start with, got a military medal in France. And when he came back, he was commissioned and he went out to India, opted to go to India, to the Indian cavalry. He thought, well, they were all armored cars this time, or tanks. And we met him on the front end. When he heard what we were doing, he volunteered to join us. And knowing the amount of meal we were going to have, we were going to write it to the vet on our strength. He had a 30 column. And he was, before he was killed, he got a military cross as well with us. And he was a very stalwart man, probably. And then he got killed in a clash with Japanese. But our own chap, our transport officer, was he had dealing with farm animals at his time. He did a short course of mule management. As he could. We didn't do the department there. There was no vet per column. And you have maybe, I think it was a vet in brigade headquarters. As I say, we were not with the brigade most of the time.
You, from the account that you give, you don't seem to have had as rough a time as some of the other chindits I've interviewed.
No, we were not engaged in any of the blocks where some very bloody fighting went on, as I admit fully. Our early problems were the physical exhaustion, the distance we covered. And I suppose it can be said that in that respect we were the only true chindits. The idea that really all the likely equipped people who got to the gun would be how we get. To that extent, yes. We had this perpetual movement until we got to Mitchell, and then we had our minor combats. But I'm not saying it, not for a moment, did we have anything like, say, for instance, our 30 column, but we were in the back four block. And the 9th Gurkha was in the back four block. But ourselves, it was really exhaustion more than anything else, told us.
Because some of them seem to look back on it as a nightmare, but does that apply to you?
Slightly. When I came out, you had thoughts. I had thoughts then. They haven't really occurred to me since. Did we do right here? Did we do wrong? Should we have done something else? Could we have done something else? But you felt that you were in the grip of some, I suppose, I'd be too melodramatic force majeure. You couldn't. Having complete control of your destiny. What were we doing? That was the point. What were we doing then? You know, why weren't we could have been better employed, I feel. But we had our job to do, we went on up north. And I think possibly it was tiredness really more than anything else that brought on some reaction when we came out. I was sometimes worrying, did I do the right thing? Did we do the right thing there? Did we do this? So on and so forth. But it wasn't, it didn't have a sort of, how should I put it, sort of 1480 war type of horror being in a trench like some of the blocks were. The living dead had been beaten out of them by those Japanese, or indeed 77 years of money long. They had never been put in there. Have you read Michael Calvert's book?
Yes, I've interviewed him as well.
Yes. Well, that gives you some indication of how badly we were using them, because his cavalry was actually colossal in comparison to the number of troops engaged.
What were the specific things which worried you about whether the right decision had been made?
It's a bit rather confusing. I mean, could we have done more without ammunition to sort these villages out? But we couldn't. I mean, it was sort of worries like that. Did we do the right thing far enough back? I wasn't column commander. To that extent, but it passed pretty quickly. I didn't had a modern day counselling for my problems at all. After, since the war, for many years, I've been sort of thinking, I've written various bits and pieces for, mainly for a regimental newsletter, and I've come to a conclusion that the tended forces are either too small or too large. Too small in that they, as such, they couldn't really hold a place to allow, which I feel should have been done, if they weren't available, reinforcing troops from the main battlefront to come in, to say Michener, to say take over Barmer and bring them down. On the other hand, we were too large to be supported adequately by air support, with the limited resources available. And when you consider the imperative minuteness of the tended efforts compared to the overall thing, it's interesting to see how it was a very expensive force in that point of view. And I'm trying to remember her name, an American lady who wrote a book about Joe Stilwell and in China. And his attitude towards the fact that the Chinese war theatre was the most important. And that Burma was merely a corridor in which the stuff could go to support Chiang Kai-shek. And that book barely mentions the Chinese. Because very you consider objectively, in a very small portion of the whole. And far more important stuff was going on outside, as far as other people were concerned. And of course this led to the problems between Chiang Kai-shek, Mountbatten and Stilwell. Well, of course, that's the war. How do these people were, what they did, you know, what they do after. But the basic thing is we are the wrong size. And I'm not certain what the first concept we understood was that it would be the best one. That is to say, two rotating brigades. It was comparatively easy to support them. They'd have gone back, had their rest and reinforcement, they'd have come back and gone on with the job. But with a large force, again, they weren't very large enough to themselves to do much, unless they'd been pulled together into a complete group and put in an attack. If they had really taken a suitable place, one of the blocks, for example, and thrown in a considerable number of properly equipped reinforcement brigades or what from India and North Burma, Assam, might have made a vast difference. So I don't think really the problem was that really winning the war was people really knew what the purpose of special forces were, what the purpose of the changes were. It was a model thinking on a gamma, as in I think really we get mistakes out of the brain for this sort of thing. But the answer to the war was get these people there, they'd defeat the Jets were defeated, they'd crumble from the inside and worse that effect. I think that the fortress stronghold concept is quite a good one. You put these things down a vast old road and rail block, and you had somebody scurrying around the outside to sort of sweep away the Japanese. But then nobody said, what then? And I can't recall any instructions about how we're going to get out of the place. So we got in there, we can dump down, what is going to happen? Will you stay there for over a day? We made our way gradually because we had to go and support these people in Michigan. And it's very much as an afterthought.
Did you get your MC for the Chindit work?
Yes, I did. I think without boasting, it started off to an immediate, because in one of these affrays against the villagers, things were going all right to a certain extent, and then suddenly things started going very wrong. And I was present at that site, and I gave various orders and took over and did this, that, and the other thing. It went into an immediate start with. And then I think later it really became what they called a routine. It's a general handout. And he did a particular occasion at the time, which seemed quite important. But looking back, was it all that important compared to other people? You read the obituaries of people getting emceeing far more really.
I think that you were in India at the time of partition in 47. If you could please give me some details about what you remember of that, please.
After I had gone out of Malaya with the 3rd Battalion, I was sent home on one of the leave schemes, possibly Python. I think Python, and it, STIF was our leave scheme. It's like STIF, as in army, why they called it STIF. But it was, and it's rather like Python for the British Army. And I went into hospital very shortly after I arrived. When I arrived, my father gave one look at me and said, "You go and see the local doctor, you're very ill." I said, "No, I'm going to go on my leave first." Anyhow, parental discipline being what it was, it took me off the local doctor, who was our local doctor, who had been in Burma with the Field Hospital. Or Chattanooga, Tennessee. Anyhow, I stopped in the hospital, spent some months there, met my wife, who was a nurse in the hospital, then I was sent back to India. After my test at home county district in Tunbridge Wells, then sent back to India in due course, arrived in our regimental centre in early 47, or late 46, late 46 I suppose, yes, with my wife with a fellow. And just by that time, trouble started brewing.
Where was the regimental centre?
A place called Bucklow. But the best way to describe it is it's north of Amritsar and Lahore in the hill. It's the nearest sort of better known place was Dalhousie, the hill station. And the regimental centre was winding down to peacetime system. I was given command of the training battalion, it was called. Misnomer, but it was rather more than a company, but not quite as big as a battalion. And eventually we had to use our recruits. And in order to regularize their position, they hadn't been yet attested. We had attested a whole lot of recruits, swore them in, they were then proper soldiers by law. And we went out on various patrols. I was sent out in one to rescue a young lady who had allegedly been abducted by some Muslims. Well, up in our part of the world, there was a reasonable, unusual, that part of India, a Muslim population said to be the descendants of the people pushed up the valley, the Kandla Valley, during one of the Muslim invasions of India. Anyhow, they allegedly pinched this girl and her family, and I was sent there on the white horse to rescue his car. And the only interesting thing about that was then across the river in Spain. That's quite an experience. So he lay continually being carted away. They had a couple of riflemen myself went there and got this girl back. Well, wasn't unduly pleased. I said, "Jesus, what happened?" And I wasn't like that until I got her back. And then we went out regularly on the trail around the hills and things. There wasn't any terrible trouble. It fell down the plain, and you could see trouble going on big. Oh, there was, yes. Our mess looked right down onto our plain to see fires, villages being burnt. Muslims burning Hindus, and Hindus burning Muslim villages. And there I was